Hey, it's Glenn Thrush with Politico's Off Message podcast. Hillary Clinton just had probably, not probably, the best victory of her political career. She wiped Bernie Sanders out in the Palmetto State. I'm calling it the Palmetto Massacre. Nearly 50 points victory there, completely eradicating her terrible loss to Barack Obama in 2008. And I personally think, I'm going to take a lot of heat for this, I think the race is essentially over on the Democratic side. I think Sanders has a very, very narrow path on Super Tuesday. He's going to get destroyed in southern states that have high African-American populations. And I think more importantly, unlike Clinton, so far this is a guy, a very disciplined candidate, an inspirational candidate who hasn't made the necessary adjustments you need to do to become president. Let me give you an example. In 2008, Hillary Clinton, after New Hampshire and after a string of losses in caucuses, was really able to get her footing in a lot of white sort of Midwestern and upper southern states. That was the territory that was available to her. Obama, by that point, had dominated the African-American vote. Well, at that point in time, that was when the Reverend Wright controversy exploded. Barack Obama and his staff, and I've talked with a lot of his staffers about this, David Axelrod and our guest this week, David Plouffe. Obama's staff was totally in a panic. They were divided and confused. They had no idea how to deal with this. A lot of them thought it was a candidacy killer. So what did they do? They sat down and decided, instead of running away from it, to give a big race speech in Philadelphia, and that was a turning point of the campaign. I was there. He took what was fundamentally a negative and turned it into a transcendent moment that really defined his candidacy. Bernie Sanders is facing that kind of a crossroads right now, again on the issue of race, which is pretty interesting, that the Democratic Party, that is still sort of the core issue in the Democratic Party. And he hasn't addressed that issue. You know, I've invited him on the podcast. I've been stalking his spokesman, Michael Briggs, who's a very nice guy, for weeks on this, wanted to talk to Sanders about growing up in New York, dealing with race issues in New York. I don't think Bernie Sanders has really addressed the race question in a way that satisfies African-American voters. And he's also had some trouble with Latino voters. Now is a pivot moment in a campaign when a candidate is tested. Hillary Clinton was tested in New Hampshire. I wrote a story talking about how dissatisfied she was with her campaign, whether or not she was going to panic and start firing people. Turns out she didn't and relied on her staff more. And she has pulled off a big victory in Nevada and this really unprecedented win in South Carolina. The question I think now in the race is, does Bernie Sanders have a second act? Is this a guy who can make some changes from a very disciplined campaign and really challenge Hillary Clinton? These were among the topics I had in a really interesting conversation last week with David Plouffe before the South Carolina primary. Plouffe puts Clinton's chances, and this was before South Carolina, at around 98% in terms of getting the nomination. But more importantly, he talked about Clinton's weaknesses, and nobody knows more about her weaknesses than Plouffe, who exploited them brilliantly in 2008 as Barack Obama's campaign manager. Specifically, what he talked about was her need, and Plouffe is a guy, by the way, who is informally consulting the Clinton campaign and has spoken with the candidate several times himself. He feels she needs to chill out, stop talking to Sidney Blumenthal, Mark Penn, whoever else is in kind of the menagerie of advisors, and stick with her core six or seven strategists that she has in Brooklyn. Seems like she's doing that. In any event, fascinating conversation with really one of the smartest and most successful political operatives of our lifetime, David Plouffe. And again, a little bit of business. We got a huge response to our Ben Carson podcast. Trevor Noah did an entire monologue on it, and I've just been inundated with emails about it. Which reminds me, subscribe to the Off Message podcast on iTunes and rate us. Please rate us. We always want the feedback. And again, email me personally, gthrush@politico.com, with any ideas, criticisms, or praise, especially praise. So we have lured David Plouffe into a residence in Southwest Washington, D.C. It's like a four-room suite. It's entirely empty. The loudest noise is the buzz of the refrigerator, right?
And I don't think this is going to end well.
He's looking in the other rooms to see if FBI agents are there. We have presented you with the suitcase, and we're waiting for the cash. Welcome, David. So I was perusing the Wikipedia before I came in. And the first thing I realized about you that I didn't know is Wikipedia says you're Jewish. You are not apparently Jewish, right?
No, I may be honorary Jewish, but no, I was raised Catholic, went to Catholic school, and now am a practicing Episcopalian.
The other thing I saw was about your dad, who passed away in 2012. He sounded like a really interesting person, and I hadn't realized there was sort of a military connection, which I guess isn't too surprising considering you grew up in Delaware. Tell me a little bit about your father.
Well, he grew up in Massachusetts, went to Natick High, went to Boston College, actually, interestingly enough, given what I'm doing now, drove a taxi to put himself through college in the streets of Boston. And, you know, yeah, was a captain in the U.S. Army in the sort of late 50s, early 60s, and worked on some really interesting things. He had a physics degree, which I cannot reveal here. But then he went to work for DuPont, which most people did in Delaware at the time. He found himself in Delaware.
But the physics stuff, I mean, you've made your reputation as being somebody who valued analytics. It was a data-driven operation. I have heard you described by positively by people as being Spock-like on your worst days. Did your father sort of share any of that stuff with you? Where'd you kind of come at that data approach?
Well, I probably got into it. This is to all the people I work with now at Uber. They won't understand what I'm saying now, but you used to have these things called box scores in the newspaper.
Oh yeah.
And so I got very much into sports and batting averages and ERAs. And I would work with him on, I was very into to math and calculus, and just always was very really interested in that. But any sort of numbers.
Stratomatic? Did you play Stratomatic as a
kid? I played All-Star baseball, which was the one you spun, and the one was the home run.
And where you also had, like, if it was a Mike Schmidt card, let's say, which I imagine you valued
greatly. Nice choice, Mike Schmidt. He had a big one.
He had a big one, and it was wide, but triples would be like a tiny little wedge. You'd
and
never
10
get a
was a strikeout, and there was a lot of 10s on Mike Schmidt's card.
Right.
So I played that incessantly and would actually like to get my son into it, but it probably isn't quite as stimulative as kids today.
I remember those. You kind of flick them with your finger.
Right.
And you were a big Phillies fan growing up.
Huge.
It's always baseball, man. Like all people who are really into politics are baseball fans. And I was the same thing, but I was a Mets fan. I used to take the box score every day, and I used to reenact the games in the backyard.
Yeah. Well, it was fascinating for me. So in 2008, within a week period, my daughter was born, my second child. Phillies win the World Series
right.
On a Thursday night. Barack Obama is elected president on a Tuesday night. And my daughter was born just after midnight on Friday morning. So I will never have a week like that. I will tell you, though, in 2007... when we were deep in the primary and working really hard, one of the only moments of real joy I had that year was when the Mets collapsed and the Phillies made the playoffs. So I just had to say that to you.
I would like you to leave.
Because in Philadelphia, it matters more that the Mets collapsed than the Phillies won.
Well, Chase Utley got us back this year, too. That was the dirtiest play I've ever seen.
It was fair.
Oh, come on,
and if
man.
He was on the Mets, you would be, worshiping him right now.
Hey, as the Clinton people in 08 would say, a typical Obama response right there. So let's talk a little bit about, back up. Bridget Mulcahy, my producer, is looking at me like, we only have so much time and Thresh wants to talk about calculus with David Plouffe. But like, you were a good calculus student?
I think I was good. I probably didn't apply myself as I should have. But yeah, I was. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed just the puzzle that was. And I've always enjoyed numbers, whether it be box scores, election outcomes, even things like barometric pressure. I've always been kind of drawn to numbers. Yeah.
No kidding.
I find a lot of people who are into politics and in baseball also kind of are into the weather. So we're talking in the middle of a tornado warning here in D.C.
Right, exactly.
That quite interesting.
And so you'd be looking at like the barometric pressure dropping and stuff. So on to, obviously what you're doing is you're trading in probabilities, right? That's what this is all about. That's what the baseball game is about, are probabilities, things are going to happen. So it's a way of sort of calculating uncertainties, right? So let's talk about uncertainty now. Hillary Clinton's just won Nevada, surprised the hell out of her own people. We were talking to staffers who were in tears the day before, didn't think they were going to pull it off. The Bernie people seem pretty stunned right now. Is this race over on the Democratic side?
It's not over yet. I will tell you what's interesting about that observation in generally. So we live in a world where we know more than we've ever known. data predictive modeling getting better and better. And yet we get surprised in politics every week.
Right.
I love that. It's kind of like sports in that way. You can have all the data and all the models and you get surprised. No, listen, I think she'll do very well in South Carolina, and I think she'll have a good Super Tuesday. And so to me, the most important date in the entire primary has always been March 15th, where you have five big states.
Yep.
New day on the calendar, Illinois, Missouri, North Carolina, Florida, and Ohio. And, you know, I think if she wins all of those or four of those, at that point, you know, no one likes talking about delegates, but it is how these are decided. And
right.
So this isn't like boxing where you can fall behind in rounds and have a knockout. If somebody gets up seven rounds in a 12-round fight, they're going to win.
Right.
And so I think she's in very, very strong position. You know, I'm sure Bernie Sanders will do quite well in Massachusetts, which is a primary, do well in the Minnesota and Colorado caucuses.
But and they're feeling Michigan. I mean, I just got off the phone with a senior Sanders person who said, quote unquote, the linchpin for them is Michigan.
Well, it may be, but here's the thing. Let's say Hillary Clinton has a very good March 1st. She wins Virginia, she wins Georgia, she wins Texas. Let's say Bernie Sanders wins Michigan 52-48. The delegates are basically split.
That's right.
And so what's fascinating is on the Clinton side, they may be where we were in 08. Which is you may still lose some contests along the way, but you've got a delegate lead that's impenetrable.
And Jill Benenson keeps going, coming to our office, only now working for her, telling us how impossible it is that Bernie could win, right? It is interesting to watch this thing play out and see the script flipped. I mean, even the Iowa-New Hampshire dynamic, obviously things are working differently. But to be down in South Carolina, I've been down there three times in the last couple of weeks, it's like 08 never happened. And that was one of the most bitter contests. You know, I'm the guy that Bill Clinton screamed shame on you at, you know, in Charleston last time. And the Clintons lost their shit in South Carolina. I mean, you guys did a real number on them. The fairy tale comment was amplified. How do I put this? Now that you're kind of a volunteer advisor for the campaign, do you feel any twinge of regret about the way that that went down?
Not one bit. not one bit. I will say before I get to that, it is interesting. So that's, again, politics. So here, I'm sure the Clintons have a different view of caucuses now than they did 8 years
ago. Oh, yeah.
They win the two. And so look at this. So in the first three states, she wins Iowa, lost it last time, loses New Hampshire, won it last time.
Right.
Now wins Nevada, but also wins the delegates. So three things happened that hadn't happened before. She's probably going to win South Carolina. So it's
by a comparable, what did you win, by 26 points last time?
We won by 28, if I recall.
I mean, she could, you know, I don't think it's going to be quite that much, but she could come really close.
She could. And Sanders looks like he's waving a white flag down there. By the way, so Sanders has run a remarkable race. I mean, to get where he's gotten, no one probably, I would assume, including even himself might have, in an honest moment like a year ago or even 8 months ago, would have imagined he'd put together a campaign like
this. 2 months ago, they were saying, you could call up Tad Devine, get him on the record. Tad will admit it, you know. Let's talk about Sanders with African-American voters. Does he have a real problem with black voters?
I don't think he has a problem. I just think Hillary Clinton has strength. So listen, we saw even in 08, we were trailing with African-American voters right up until January of 08. And then once we won Iowa and the thing got more real, we were able to open up things up in South Carolina. And then we're opening up a national lead. So she's very strong. So I don't think this is about Sanders' weakness. I think it's the fact that she is going to perform very well with the African-American vote on Saturday in South Carolina. I think she'll perform well with the African-American vote and Latino vote throughout the South on the 1st. And I think that also has import in the 15th, where, again, I think on March 15th, if she sweeps those five states or does four of the five, you know, again, I'm sure Bernie Sanders will go on to win some states, but the delegate race will be largely settled.
Okay, if we're going to do All-Star baseball here, and we're looking at the size of the home run here, I mean, would you? I know you hate to do this stuff, but if you were to sort of put a probability on Hillary getting the nomination, what would it be at this point in time?
98%.
So you feel that confident about the way this is going to be?
And partially because we went through this last time, so you just have a great understanding for what the process is and what it isn't. And it is not about winning certain states or momentum or winning the press cycle. It's about delegate acquisition.
Which is what she fundamentally understands now that she did not understand last time.
Right. So you need, if you to use a business term, you bid a business model to succeed based on the rules of the contest. And the rules of the contest are delegate acquisition.
And when you, I know you don't want to speak, this was an in-camera conversation and we reported on it last year. You met with her at her place in Whitehaven. You can tell me to jump in a lake. But was that part of what the conversation was, getting her to really understand that this is a numbers game and that it's all about delegate acquisition?
Well, I think that was apparent to her right after 08.
So she really understood.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I think the two things she really took out of that were, well, three. I need to build a stronger grassroots campaign and organization. I need to utilize technology in a much more focused and central way to the campaign. And I need to be focused on delegates. And my sense is, you know, in the general election, what you need to carry forward is this is not a national campaign. You're basically running for governor in 8 to 10 states.
Right.
And so that has to be the approach. And that headquarters is basically there to service the states. Tried to be what we did in both of our campaigns, and it wasn't perfect. But that orientation is really, really important.
Well, you could see it geographically when you'd go up to Prudential Plaza and you'd see the state rooms lining. I mean, it was sort of the dominant aspect of it, was kind of the state focus. You'd even sort of see state memorabilia all over the place, which was something you did not see in Ballston when you went to the Clinton campaign. I think you saw empty Valium bottles and vodka. But that really has changed. Now, Robbie Mook, who is her campaign manager, is somebody who over the years has been somewhat close to you. You guys have a good relationship. He did a pretty damn good job in Nevada and a pretty damn good job in Iowa. I mean, how would you sort of assess the ground operation looking at it from a distance?
Very strong. So if their ground operation was not as strong as it was, or even say what they had in 08, she would have lost Iowa. So I think that the organization on the ground really saved them. And
again, a complete flip
whether
of the
it's
script.
Right, whether it's worth 5 points in Nevada, I don't know, but it was worth close to that. So he's done a great job. And you know, these are hard. So you know, after the New Hampshire loss, you're just in the barrel. You're in the penalty box. It sucks. But you just got to put your head down and know that, okay, let's dig out in Nevada. Even if we lose that, we'll win South Carolina. We'll have a good March. These things are, you know, you just, Robbie has a steadiness to him. And I think he's more strategic than tactical.
Right.
And I think that's really important in that position. And I think he's done a great job. And in my sense is, I watched a little bit of her town hall last night when I landed here in Washington. And I haven't done much of that.
Right.
And it was really, I thought she was very effective. I thought she was very strong. I think she was connecting. So I think she's hitting her stride out there, too.
Well, she's better, I think, with the African-American stuff. But back to Robbie for a second. The flames were really licking him after New Hampshire. I wrote a story talking about kind of a potential staff shakeup. That was true at the time. And I think Joel Benenson, your old friend, has had issues connecting with the Clintons. Do you think Robbie's in good shape now? And do you think people ought to just leave him alone?
Yeah, I think you build your team and you stick by your team and you run. I mean, listen, so I will tell you, in 08, we were the neophyte. We didn't have a lot of political barnacles, so we were pretty much able to run the campaign we wanted to run. And we had plenty of doubters in the Democratic Party, many, who thought trying to win states like Virginia and Indiana and Florida was crazy. But we were able to do our own thing. It was harder in 12 because you become more of the establishment. So it's got to be very hard for the Clintons. They've been on the scene for decades.
Right.
So anytime things go wrong, they have dozens of people, you know, in their mail, in their email box and probably calling saying, told you so, you got to do this, you got to do this. And one of the tests for her is, so they had a moment of trial now after New Hampshire. You know, I'm sure there'll be another one in the primary, maybe not. There'll be many in the general. You're going to have your valleys.
Right.
And that's always a test. And if the thing you do is so internal tension and allow voices from the outside to really, I think, affect the campaign in a negative way, you may not win. I mean, running for president is one of the hardest things in the world, if not the hardest. You're going to be tested in ways you can see and not see. And, you know, every day is not going to be a good day. In fact, many of them are going to be horrific. And you're going to think you can't even get out of your own way. But you got to stick with your team and you got to stick to the strategy.
And part of that is you've used in the barrel. I mean, that was sort of a mantra around the White House. I remember during the Gulf spill, we're in the barrel today. We're not necessarily going to be in the barrel tomorrow. Of course, you were in the barrel for like 45 days. But that is an issue. Having covered her in 08, that is not her characteristic. When things go wrong, she seeks multiple inputs. One of the things that I recall, and I probably wrote it in one of the ebooks, I don't know if it was you, But you guys took away Obama's, or asked him to not look at his iPad so much, right? That was you, right?
I would never do that.
But to sort of cut out these external inputs, and dare I mention the name Valerie Jarrett, I will not discuss that, but there was a sense from perhaps others on the campaign that Valerie was bringing in external things. Do you think Hillary would be wise if they would be a little bit more disciplined about the number of people that they talk to externally?
Well, I will. Now, you mentioned Valerie, so, you know, I traveled with her a lot of 12, and right. She was actually, I think, a very helpful influence in terms of making sure the president was not, reading everything that right. was written. She had a good perspective there. I think, listen, you don't want to be so cloistered
right.
that you think you're the only geniuses in the world and you are immune to outside advice, but you got to limit that. It's hard running for president. It takes everything you have as a candidate just to execute every day.
Right. But you could tell, you knew Barack Obama not when he was nobody, but you knew him when he was a freshman senator. It's got to be extremely hard for, given the structure of their world and the fact that these guys have been really on top of the game for three decades now, to have somebody to say, let's cut down the inputs.
Right, but you need to do that. And, you know, so let's say in the general election, assuming she's the nominee, and I think she will. So that'll be a challenge, right? So you have your data and your modeling and your polling and your theory of how you win a battleground state.
Right.
And then someone who was a governor terms ago or a decade ago says, I think you're all wrong. That'll be the test. You want to be respectful, but on the other hand, it's your race, it's different time, different opponent, and technology and data have gotten so much better.
Right.
So that'll be the test. Are you going to listen? And I think they will. And I think Robbie's built a campaign to assure that. But that'll be a test, because there'll be moments when there's some bad bullshit public poll that comes
yep.
out that shows them tied in Pennsylvania.
Yep.
And with all due respect, Ed Rendell will call and say, you got to knock off Virginia and come here for 3 days.
And everybody's knees turn to water.
Well, and you've just got to calmly say no, because our numbers show that we're in good shape. Now, if you have advice for us, we're all ears, but we're not going to jettison our campaign strategy. I mean, that would be like me. Listen, in 10 years from now,
yeah.
when I offer my observations about how to win the Iowa caucuses, it won't be worth a damn dime.
Well, that's funny. You said this okay. to me a couple of weeks ago when we chatted. I was like, you said, I'm like a year and a half away from being completely useless, right? Like, everything's changing so quickly.
It's changing so quickly. And so, you know, I think, you know, yeah, I mean, I remember when we were going through some debates in the White House, you know, there was one around contraception, as you know, and there was some suggestion that somehow we had just cost ourselves the ability to win Ohio and Pennsylvania. And that was people thinking about Ohio and Pennsylvania from the 1980s.
Yeah, it's true.
So it's just things change very, very quickly.
When you look at her as a candidate, and you said you watched the town hall, and I do think, by the way, I think the focus, it's pretty interesting, the focus on the African-American community has clarified her message in a way that I don't think was clear before. It's really interesting the way you'll get something that kind of crystallizes, reminds, sometimes a candidate needs to be reminded of who the hell they are, right? Do you think in general so far, if you're looking at her performance, do you think she is comparable to 08, better or worse?
She's better. Now, you know, everyone talks about sort of the post-Ohio to June Hillary Clinton, and there's no doubt she was campaigning with a little bit more freedom and looseness, but I think she's much better now. But sometimes it does take that. I look back to our primary. You might remember we were kind of stumbling around the wilderness in Pennsylvania.
Oh, yeah.
Lost that. And heading into Indiana, North Carolina, Reverend Wright reemerged. And if you remember, we had a battle.
He gave the speech at the National Press Club.
Never forget
that,
it.
That just blew the shit up again.
Right. Yep. So, by the way, no one's had that moment in this campaign yet. That was a very, very difficult situation. But maybe someone will be tested like that. But you remember, we had a debate around suspending the gas tax
yeah.
in Indiana. And I think we and certainly then Senator Obama kind of got our mojo back, because that was kind of the kind of fight why we got into this race, that this was kind of a phony answer to something as opposed to a real solution. So sometimes you need something like that to kind of snap back and be reminded about what your core message is.
One last thing on her, and then I want to go on to Trump, because you said some interesting things about Trump, particularly about kind of the debates and what a matchup would be like. The one observation, and I've written about this, and you know, this is the opinion of a lot of people who are close to her, the one sort of structural deficiency that she seems to have built into this campaign is we don't have a strategist in the way that, now you guys sort of divided that command, but it was very clear that Axe was the message guy, and you obviously played a role in that, but you were more operational. Do you think, now Joel is the chief strategist, but he's also the pollster, and that was a setup that they had with Mark Penn. But clearly that was a negative, in retrospect, for a lot of the Clinton people. Mark Penn was sort of a negative force. He dominated, he influenced too much. Do you think there is a need for one more piece internally, like a strategist kind of sitting at the center of this? I mean, would you recommend that they add a bit?
Well, I don't have a tremendous amount of visibility into how that's set up. I will say this. If you step back and say the advertising over the last couple weeks, has that been strong? I think it has been. Her remarks, their sort of strategy around Nevada and South Carolina. I mean, that seems to be working pretty darn well.
Right.
So I think the output's more important than the internal drama. But I do think, you know, you do need to make sure that it's not a conference call or meeting of 10 equals. This general election, no matter who's on the other side, will be brutal.
And that is tough. It's more, you know, I've been hearing it's more than 10.
So whatever it is, I think, you know, you have to have, and listen, you know, David Axelrod and Barack Obama had a unique relationship. You know, there was just a lot of trust there, and he really got his voice.
Right.
You know, I came from an advertising and messaging background, so, you know, that was something that was quite natural to me, even though my primary responsibilities were around electoral strategy and organization. I think that you do need to figure out whether it's one voice, two voice. There has to be, you know, there's the big call and the big meeting, and then there's the real meeting and the real call.
Right.
That's a little bit flip. But you can't make decisions with 10 people.
That's right.
I mean, it's actually impossible. Whether you're in politics, business, or family, it's impossible. So you've got to figure out. And, you know, the question is, who is she talking to? And listen, they've got enormous. Joel Benenson, Mandy, Jim Margolis, you know, Jen Palmieri. These are super smart. I've worked with almost all of them intensively. These are super smart people. So I don't think it's necessarily, you know, is there a missing person from the outside? It's, you've got to commit to something.
Again,
and what's the structure going to be?
Getting back to what you said before, kind of cutting out some of the external inputs and trusting the people who are the engine internally, right?
Yes.
But trust is really. I mean, this is, you know, she's been in a lot of campaigns. Trust is a difficult commodity for somebody who's been through a lot of the things that she has been through.
But this one's going to work out just fine. So this is an interesting period. Iowa, very close win. Bernie wins New Hampshire, and I think there must have been a sense of, oh, here we go again.
Right. No, there was.
They've stabilized. And again, people say, how can you say that? There's only been three. Well, she's going to win South Carolina. We're just going to debate about how large the margin is. And I think she's set up for a very good March 1 and 15. So the truth is, I think on the morning of March 16th, she will be able to look back and say, you know what? My team weathered the storm. We weathered the storm. The strategy worked. And that's how you build trust. And you go through something like that, you're just more likely to trust the team the next time you have a moment of trial or tribulation.
The one last thing, and then we'll move on. Her online fundraising hasn't been anything approaching what you guys were able to do, what Bernie was able to do. And by the way, in 2008, people seem to forget she did very well with online fundraising for a really long period of time. Why do you think she's struggling with it? And I guess that dovetails into the conversation about kind of youth vote.
Well, she's got, you know, just great digital talent. I mean, Teddy Goff is the best person I've ever met, and he's the lead strategist in this. So this is not about anything sort of technical. I think that, listen, we struggled, as you know, in 2012.
That's right.
Our online fundraising, I mean, the activism, the volunteerism was there early, but the fundraising did not kick in until we got into the spring and early summer.
Because people perceive the threat, right? It's the threat that always motivates people.
Right. So, and I think, listen, so right now I think a lot of people think, you know, maybe Bernie won New Hampshire, but she's going to be okay.
Right.
So there's the urgency question. And then, listen, Hillary Clinton's great strengths, I think, as a general election candidate and as a president, strength, solidity, she's very rational. Primaries are about excitement.
Right.
And so I think that's going to be more challenging for her. But it'll be there because, okay, I didn't sleep much in 8 or 12 because I thought the difference between a President Obama and McCain or President Obama and Romney was so profound and would affect the world in so many ways that we had to win. But the differences between her and whoever's on the other side will be the widest we've seen since probably Johnson and Goldwater. So anybody out there that doesn't want to see, you know, whether it's Trump or Cruz or Rubio is going to come with guns a-blazing to help her.
It seems like we're into the world of counterintuitives now. I think starting off, people were talking about Trump as being an absolute dream draw for her, that he's such an outrageous character. Now you're starting to hear people, spoke with a couple of pretty prominent people in Ohio the other day who said that Trump could really be tough. Is your view that Trump is a weak general election candidate, or that he could cause her real trouble?
I don't think we know yet. And I think all of us should have learned by now not to get out of ourselves with Trump. My sense, though, is this, that he could completely implode. Okay, so you say, well, how can someone, really ferociously and viciously attack the last former Republican president and get into a worldwide verbal tangle with the Pope and come out okay? Well, he did. But general elections are a different thing. And you get closer. People take that decision very seriously. What happened with McCain and Palin, the price McCain paid was people thought, you know what? The decision you just made about who would become president if something happened to you is so important. And you clearly just did it for political reasons. It killed him and on sort of judgment. So my sense is that it may be that enough swing voters say, no way, no how, on temperament first and then on positions. But if I think that's a likely possibility, that Hillary Clinton could beat Donald Trump by an unheard of margin,
right,
nationally of 6 to 10 points. But if that's not the case and he's competitive, where he'll be competitive is in the upper Midwest. In the Ohios, the Wisconsins, maybe Pennsylvanias of the world, maybe Iowa and Minnesota, even potentially. But you look at the Colorados and Nevadas and Virginias and Floridas of the world.
He flips them the other way.
I think so. So from an electoral college standpoint, I don't see a Trump path. But he's the only one left that I think causes a lot of uncertainty.
Just
whether
because
it's Cruz or Rubio, you kind of know what you're taking, what you're getting. I think the electoral strategy is quite clear. I think both of them would lose in an electoral college battle to Hillary Clinton. Trump is a wild card, and you just don't know. And even in Virginia, I think Trump would, in a general election, do very, very poorly in Northern Virginia, very poorly in Henrico County. But does he overperform Romney and McCain, for instance, and even Bush in southwestern part of the state? He could.
I guess it depends.
We just don't know.
And it depends on how beat up is. Okay, so let's look at the Republican side. He's really run the table. And now we have kind of the... we have a Napoleonic imperative here. He's got 40% or 35% or 30%, and his enemies are divided equally as 22 and 22%, and they're strong enough to survive, but not strong enough to combine and defeat him, right? What do you think the probability is that he's going to win the nomination? And B, what kind of event could possibly occur at this point to change the trajectory?
Well, I'll combine those two questions into this. Remarkably, this is completely in his control. If he can land the plane, he wins. So this notion, by the way, I mean, first of all, you can tell the venom. So I don't think any of Cruz, Rubio, Kasich, they do not think Donald Trump being the Republican nominee is a good outcome.
Right.
But even a worse outcome is one of the other ones becoming the nominee.
Right.
So, and if you're Kasich, why would you get out? You got Ohio and Michigan.
Right.
So,
and you also have a story to tell that you feel compelled to tell.
Right. But okay, let's say it's March 2nd.
Right.
I think the chances of this happening are zero. But let's say it's March 2nd.
Right.
And Ted Cruz and John Kasich says, you know, good old Marco deserves to go mano a mano with Donald Trump. It's too late. March 1 just happened.
And that's that.
People are already voting. In Ohio, they'll be voting in Florida, North Carolina. Like, people are voting in the March states.
Right.
So it's too late. It needed to happen 2-3 weeks ago. That's my view. Now, Trump, who knows? Tuesday night, he could do something. It's hard to top attacking the Pope or George Bush or calling Ted Cruz a little whiny baby or whatever he did. But he could do something so detrimental and destructive. Or he just doesn't run a disciplined campaign. But I was interested. I was... I saw Senator Mark Warner earlier today, and we're done, so he's going to Virginia again on Monday,
right?
And he's going to a small town outside of Roanoke. Very smart. That's one thing he didn't do in Iowa. He basically bounced around the Iowa cities and Cedar Rapids and
show the
Davenports.
Flag. Yeah,
he wasn't like thinking about I need to get out of those areas, and I think because it was probably inconvenient for him,
right?
So he I saw that Ivanka Trump taped a message about how to participate in the Nevada caucus. Really smart. So they start, it seemed like they're running a more professional campaign. So if he would just prepare for the debates even a little bit, And not be Donald Trump. So be right. Crazy, say whatever right, stuff, right. But just be prepared a little bit. He's going to be their nominee. It's crazy to think that. I don't see, because just like on the Democratic race, from a delegate acquisition standpoint,
it's done. Yeah.
He could be in such a strong position by mid-March that even with big states to come, like Pennsylvania and New Jersey and California, the die is cast.
It's so funny. So we're sitting here 2 weeks, 10 days after everybody's talking about this being the craziest election of our lifetime. And we probably have the two candidates.
Probably. I mean, I think, but listen, what if Trump loses Texas, he underperforms in Georgia, he doesn't win Virginia, Rubio wins Florida, Kasich wins Ohio and Michigan. Somehow Rubio wins North Carolina, maybe Cruz wins Missouri. I'm not sure any of those things would happen.
Well, you know,
but there's a scenario, okay? Yeah. But so my point is Trump is in control of his destiny. If he runs a smart, disciplined campaign for the next 3 weeks, he's almost assuredly going to be the Republican nominee.
Wow. So Rubio, the Rubio people sort of fancy themselves as the neo-Obama crowd. I mean, Rubio uses the language of that, and those guys are very flinty and very, they had a strategy of laying in the weeds. Do you think they just blew it and made a mistake strategically?
Well, to be fair to them, I mean, how do you handle the Trump phenomenon? I mean, I wouldn't know how to handle it. So let's be fair. This is very, very complicated. I think that, they had their goal, if I remember, to go 3-2-1.
Right.
They went 3-5-2, and then they went 2. So, I will give Senator Rubio credit. I mean, he bounced back after the New Hampshire debate debacle very well. So I think that woulda, coulda, shoulda. The Trump thing is a living, breathing, growing organism. That there is no rules for how you deal with it.
I mean, what is
my
it?
Understanding is he's not even running any advertising in Super Tuesday states. So, I work for Uber now. We talk about how Uber's disrupted the transportation market. He's disrupted politics. Now, the question is, maybe only Donald Trump could run this kind of race.
Right.
But he's doing it completely different. So I have a lot of sympathy for these Republican candidates who are dealing with something. There's no playbook for this. We've never seen anything like this. But Donald Trump did not create the conditions for his rise. He's tapping into them.
Right, but he has this unique set of attributes that allow him to capitalize on it that you can't think of someone else possessing, right? So it's the man meeting the moment. So these attributes, environmental conditions, how do you describe them? I mean, are we, on the Democratic side, there's a little bit more of like an ennui and a scratchiness. On the Republican side, there's full-blown freak-out, scared shitless anxiety, right? And that's what he's tapping in on, and he's giving real big, fat, simple answers to very complex questions, right? So, like, how does this flame burn itself out? I mean, does it burn itself out?
Well, he is. It's interesting. Ronald Reagan was known as the Teflon president. Trump has proven himself to be the Teflon candidate. It's quite remarkable. And I think that, and I find this interesting because when I was in the White House, obviously, we had our share of challenges with the Republican Congress, and they blocked a lot of things we wanted to do and contributed to a debt ceiling crisis. But yet the grassroots Republican voters think the Republican leadership in Congress has rolled over for Obama,
right?
Has not impeached him. They're as angry at the Republican establishment as they are at President Obama and the Democrats. And so they're hankering for someone from the outside who tells it like it is, who's tough. I think Trump's toughness cannot be overstated enough is the reason he never backs down.
Right.
Ever.
Right.
On anything. And people are looking for that in the Republican Party.
But, okay, so here's the thing. I mean, I was talking to Sharpton the other day, always a fun conversation. And he knows Trump for like 30 years, right? And they talk. And he is dead certain that the minute Trump wraps up enough delegates that he tacks fast to the center. My question is, it seems like he would have to do that to be competitive at all. But isn't that kryptonite? Like the minute he does that, doesn't he lose his credibility?
For anybody else. So yeah, you could see him at a press conference and, he won't move to the center on everything, but on a few issues. And Glenn Thrush might be in the press conference and say, wait, Donald Trump, you've now changed positions on X, Y, and Z. And he'll say, right, Glenn, I have.
Well, I was
in a primary.
Right.
And I did what I needed to do. And now I'm trying to win a general election. You want to call it flip-flopping, you want to call it moving, call whatever what you want. That's what I'm doing. So he'll be transparent. He'll own it. And maybe that will be a bridge too far for some conservatives and they'll sit out or they'll hope for a third party.
But he's telling it like it is.
Yes. That's exactly what he'll do. And so he'll do what no politician's been able to do, which is he will turn flip-flopping somehow into
a virtue
or something he can survive.
Wow.
I think Reverend Sharpton's right about that.
What positions do you see him sort of, if you were to look at one or two positions that he might flip-flop on, what would you identify?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, I would say this. Trump has been the least predictable of the Republicans. So he has said he wouldn't just throw out the Iran deal.
Right.
He has said he believes, now this is the one thing he tried to clean up, he believed the mandate has some virtue.
Right.
He doesn't want people on the streets. So you could see him like nodding towards climate change, for instance.
Right.
I think it's hard for him to do anything on immigration, given what a big part of his primary that's been. You could see him on tax policy, where he said he wants to get rid of carried interest, going even further and saying, I do think we should have some revenue from raising taxes on the wealthy. You know, you could see him on education spending. So I think he'll do some things that are against Republican orthodoxy, some of them being complete reversals from what he
right.
did, some of them being more just shades.
He's very Rudy Giuliani, in terms of what, just sort of modally, he's very Rudy Giuliani to me. Like, he's a very familiar cast of kind of things, with a lot of flexibility moving within, but like, tough as hell, but everything else is kind of negotiable, right?
Right. The one thing that's not is toughness and
right.
certainty.
Right.
You know, that those are his hallmarks.
How do you attack him? Like, if you're running her campaign, you knew I was going to get around to that. I mean, give me one or two ways that you think he could be undermined.
Well, I mean, I'll be honest. I'm glad I'm not there, because I don't know if I have the chops for dealing with this. This is a whole different level of kung fu. Okay,
and do we have a false? We don't have any sort of false modesty meter around here.
But I think, you know, it's a general election. You've got to generate huge Democratic turnout, including amongst young people, right. which I think is her biggest electoral challenge in the fall. And you need to raise the stakes. For swing voters. So I'm not sure that you somehow say he's not a strong person, he's a weak person. I think you'd point out the fact that you can't trust him. So this is where she has some trust issues, according to polling.
Right.
If he does flop all around, that will be something you can take advantage of.
To neutralize his own questions
right.
about her
trust.
But
you don't know where this guy's going to be. The only thing he cares about is winning. He
right.
doesn't care about people.
Right.
But I think at the end of the day, you're just going to want to paint the pictures on the issues. So basically, we can have more bellicosity and war, or we can put diplomacy first. We can kick 20 million people off healthcare or not. We can do something about a warming planet or not. We can believe in education. We can have a more fair and tolerant and just society. Those are big issues. And Trump will try and shade them. And that's why I think definition is important here. Every general election, whoever defines the race and their opponent first generally wins.
Which is what you were able to do in 2012 with Romney with the Bain Capital stuff.
As George Bush was to John Kerry in 2004, as Bill Clinton did to Bob Dole in 1996. So even this is an open seat race.
In the Old West stuff, this no one's got a quicker draw at high noon than this dude does. So she's got a... she's got to draw really fast because he has already started this stuff and he has got an ear for this like I've never seen before in terms of finding weakness.
He does, but I think, so here's the great thing about where we are today in terms of politics. Their campaign will know exactly in Virginia, in Ohio, in Florida, in Iowa, in Nevada, in Colorado, who is a danger to not turn out, who's a firm Clinton supporter, who is an actual available swing voter, what concerns them about Trump. And you basically are running a campaign to those people.
So this is where the metrics, this is where you kick this stuff up to a different, to a level,
yes.
even unseen.
A level of sophistication and knowledge about the electorate and the battleground states that just gets advanced every 4 years. And, you know, so if I know Glenn Thrush, if I know this is what Glenn Thrush is concerned about, maybe you're truly undecided. You've got concerns about Clinton,
right.
concerns about Trump. I'm going to run a campaign to you. And
it sounds very similar to kind of a caucus approach where you're talking about one, twos, and threes, right?
Our view in the presidential races and the general election is we basically wanted to run it like a small state rep race. We wanted to get that level of granularity on voters.
That is an enormous expense. Enormous yeah. expense.
Well, and it only works with passionate people on the ground because you can't just buy this. The money's important, but what matters is the troops on the ground who will go out there and talk to their neighbors. And that is, and I think the more we spend time behind our devices all day long, the more people cherish and value and trust human one-on-one interaction.
A couple more things and I'll let you go. By the way, thanks for taking the time. Let's talk about the youth thing. The one thing that her victory in Nevada seems to buy her, I think, and I presume they're using the time and resources intelligently, is to figure out some way to at least erode this incredible gap. Like, I forgot what the number was, but it's 7-1 in the under 30s in Nevada. That's unacceptable. I mean, that's unheard of. It was worse in New Hampshire. How does she begin to start making, clearly she's not going to dance as fast as Bernie on this stuff, but how does she begin to at least erode this gap?
Well, you know, you see in some of her appearances, she's acknowledging it straight on, which is, I know I haven't done as well with young people and they've got legitimate concerns about the country and also questions for me. So I think that's healthy.
Right.
There's not trying to hide it under the rug. My suspicion is under 30, she'll do better in South Carolina. I think you'll see her do better in Texas. I think you'll see her do quite well in Georgia. So we shouldn't over-extrapolate just based on a couple of early contests.
Which were lily white states.
But what matters at the end of the day, and so I think you'll see her share of vote under 30 get better, but Sanders will still do very, very well there. So the question is, if you're the nominee, how do you put that back together? So I have no doubt if Hillary Clinton's a nominee, you know, Bernie Sanders, I think in a debate said this, no matter what happens, we need to come together. He'll do the right thing. But
so you think Bernie Sanders as a surrogate getting out in the field is going to be useful?
I'm sure everyone will. The stakes are so enormous. But that's not enough. Meaning, you know, in Des Moines, Iowa, there's, you know, I don't know, 250, 300 people under 30 who are really involved in the Sanders campaign. Same thing in Manchester. Same thing in Columbus, Ohio.
Right.
Same thing in Tampa, Florida. You got to go out there and talk to those people. Invite them to meet with your campaign. Hear them out. Hear their criticisms. And make sure they understand that the shared goal of a more prosperous and fair economy, one that's growing for everyone, the right kind of foreign policy, you share that. You may not agree with everything she's ever said or done, and that the stakes are huge and that they're welcome in the campaign. I think it's going to take a campaign within a campaign.
That's interesting.
To get that right. And then even if Bernie Sanders had never emerged in the way he did, the part of the Obama coalition that I've always thought would be the hardest for her is people under 30.
Because you were able to capitalize on that.
He had a unique relationship. And what's fascinating about it, in 08, we know, there was sort of a giddy enthusiasm.
Right.
Young turnout was huge. 12, it was not giddy enthusiasm, but turnout amongst people under 30 in battleground states was up in most of them. That surprised the hell out of people.
Really?
And
that was that because of your data operation?
It was because I think it was a sort of steely resilience on behalf of young people where they said, Mitt Romney and Barack Obama are very different.
Right.
One understands the future I want to live in, one doesn't. And yeah, we had good data, we had good organizing, great organizers on the ground. But they sort of took it upon themselves, okay? They did it. They turned out. And so for her, I think the combination of the stakes, I do think if Trump's the candidate, there'll be a lot of young people that just can't imagine him representing ourselves in the world. But it's going to take an enormous amount of attention. Because I think Hillary Clinton, if she runs against Donald Trump, again, that's the one where there could be some certain states may be closer than we think and others may break open. But against the Republican nominee, she should win an Electoral College majority. But how does a Virginia win of 2 to 3 points or an Ohio win of 2 to 3 points become a tie ball game or you lose by a half a point?
Right.
You miss your marks on turnout amongst young people. Maybe you don't get quite the African-American share in turnout. And you begin to see that. You know, Barack Obama was very, very strong with suburban women. I think that's a place that Hillary Clinton can do very well, but it's going to take work. So the Obama coalition is the Obama coalition.
Right. Well, I don't know if you heard my podcast with the president. One of the things that really, I think, took Hillary Clinton by surprise was his discussing, I think, his appreciation for what she went through in 2008. Do you think, and a lot of people interpreted that as I did, him sort of questioning Bernie Sanders' experience. Do you think he's not going to endorse, well, he's left open the door to endorsing. Do you think he favors her to Sanders?
Now, I've been around long enough not to answer that question. he has spoken about this, when he's asked about it, his views of both of the candidates. I think it's very important to him that he be succeeded by a Democrat. Both to protect his legacy, but I think he's even more focused on building on it. He's right to kind of let the primary play out.
But, I mean, one of the things I have noticed is, and Sanders said something, and I asked Sharpton about this, Sanders said something about Hillary sort of hugging him just in order to get black votes. I presume you don't agree with that assessment either, right?
No, it was offensive and wrong. And I understand in the heat of a campaign, we all say things we'd regret. But there's no doubt. I mean, I think that, listen, Senator Sanders voted for a lot of key Obama agenda items.
Right.
I think he has been a good supporter. There's no doubt that, you know, he's probably been less robust in his embrace of the last 8 years than Hillary Clinton has been. So for those of us that have worked, you know, so passionately for that project, you know, that doesn't go unnoticed. But again, I think that, so listen, my guess is if he had it to do over again, he'd take that particular comment back. But, you know, he has been a strong supporter of most of the president's agenda. But there's no doubt that I think, and again, this is one of those things, would you have guessed eight years ago that Hillary Clinton would be embracing this president and what he's done so strongly, but she has.
But I think,
by the way, I don't think she thinks about that first through the prism of politics. I think she happens to agree with almost everything.
And that's exactly the point I want to end this on. It seems to me at this point in time that this process has, as tough as it has been, has actually kind of brought them together in a way that nothing else has. I mean, she was genuinely touched by the comments that he made about her dancing backwards in heels, right? She was. And it seems to me that she seems to be, insofar as she's relying so heavily on African-American supports, what's won her Nevada, I think she has a greater appreciation for what he may have dealt with as the first black president. I mean, do you think these guys are appreciating, and you know, no one was a more vicious hand-to-hand combatant than you, but I mean, do you think that this process is actually sort of giving them a better understanding of each other?
Well, yeah, I think it strengthened, but it was always there. I mean, I'll never forget, you know, after I think we secured the nomination on June 3rd, and I remember that night, then Senator Clinton gave a speech and didn't seem to, you know, in our view, sort of realize
in New York
that we had won. And, you know, his was, guys, just knock it off, okay? Like, she'll do what she needs to do. This is hard. None of you guys are running, you know. You're, like, in the room doing strategery, but you're not running. You don't know what it's like. He's always been that way. And, you know, when he... You know, I remember when I talked to him about the possibility that he'd pick Hillary Clinton. You know, it was like, really? And he just, he's talked about why. I don't need to expound on that. I think that, I mean, I will say this. It is a fascinating moment in American history.
It is.
So the Clinton-Obama primary is probably one of the more interesting elections we've had as a country, in ways more interesting than the two general election wins we had, much more so from just a character and history. And serving under him as Secretary of State, if she ends up being elected president, it's a remarkable, I'd assume, you know, if we still have books and movies in 50 years,
I hope so.
They will be many about that period. But I think the other thing I think is, listen, my strong suspicion is that Barack Obama will go down as one of our more consequential presidents. So I think he should go down as one of our greatest presidents. But even those, consequential is different than greatest.
Right.
So in the last 100 years, who were truly consequential presidents? Well, clearly Franklin Roosevelt. Dwight Eisenhower was as a general, probably not as a president. Maybe you throw the combined Kennedy-Johnson years.
I don't think maybe, but...
And then Barack Obama, I think, on that level.
Great, Reagan? You know,
Reagan? And Reagan, of course.
Yeah.
And I think that's where...
But not Bill Clinton.
Bill Clinton was a very good president, but very good. But again, I think what you've seen with... And partially this is... you know, Bill Clinton came in after George H.W. Bush, different than George W. Bush. So, but the point is, tax policy, healthcare that's eluded the country for 100 years, making a firm move towards leading the country and world on climate change, gay marriage, trying to do everything you can for the immigrant community, foreign policy fundamentally changed. Like, things have moved in a fundamental direction.
Right.
In a consequential way.
So when you hear Bernie Sanders, it's been a line for Hillary that Bernie is disrespecting the president. Do you think Bernie Sanders has been disrespectful to the president in terms of his achievements?
I don't think he's been disrespectful. I think that he just hasn't fully embraced all of them. He's embraced plenty of them. But I think the Affordable Care Act is a great accomplishment. I think Wall Street reform, so-called Dodd-Frank, is a great accomplishment and are meaningful for the country and our economy.
So my last thing is, is this a? I hear everyone talking about how much fun they're having this year, right? I'm not having that much fun. Maybe that's just me. Put this in the context: 2016 with 2008 and 2012. Is this scaring the shit out of you?
You mean as an American citizen?
As an American citizen. I guess what I'm asking is, David, is everything going to be okay?
Everything's going to be okay. I mean, I think there's a growing populism in both party, and populism has always played an important role in our country. And I do think the parties are getting more and more polarized, which will make it harder to get things done. I think it'll be okay. I mean, this is, so for some, I mean, I do think, listen, campaigns are never fun when you're going through them, whether you're waging them or covering them.
Right.
You know, you never sleep, and they're just brutal.
Yeah.
They're the privilege of a lifetime to be a part of, but they're very brutal. I think it'll all be okay. And I think it's a fascinating race. If you end up with a Trump-Clinton matchup, that will be one for the ages. It will be one for the ages. And, you know, my strong suspicion is Hillary Clinton will be our next president, our first woman president. If she wins, I think she's likely to be a two-term president. So you could have 16 years Obama-Clinton. Think about that from the 08 primary.
Amazing.
And what that's going to mean. Longest run, by the way, since Roosevelt Truman. So,
or we could have at least 4 years of a Trump Palin.
Right. So I think that it is interesting. I mean, it's funny when I get scared is I travel quite a bit now outside of the U.S.
and yeah.
People are deathly afraid of what's happening here. And I think Barack Obama has been a calming influence. I think they like his presence and American presence in the world. But even those that don't, the ban all Muslims, the sort of militaristic and bombastic, and it's not just Trump, it's all of them.
Right.
It scares people. And that's when it does dawn on me that this presidential campaign, it's not scaring the hell out of me, but it is scaring the hell out of a lot of people outside the U.S. and I'm sure in the U.S. too.
Well, on that semi-optimistic, semi-terrifying note, David, thanks so much for coming into this drug sting apartment. And we're all going to take Ubers out of here, right?
Well, you must. although there is a storm outside, so I apologize if we're surging a little bit. But particularly in a moment like today, Uber is your best alternative.
I'll pay my $60 to get back home to Maryland. Thanks again, David.
Thanks.